Good morning. It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn so far on the Ideas Network today. Well, you're not supposed to see how the sausage is being made. So here's here's what happened last hour. We connect me to the rest of the world through a telephone system called ISDN. And I'm in Superior, and Rhonda and all the producers are in Milwaukee. And we have a blizzard going on up here, and we've had power outages off and on. And wouldn't you know, we had had one, and it zapped our machine, and I had to fix it so we could get it back together. Hopefully, there's enough baling twine and chewing gum involved here that we'll be able to hold things together for this program at any rate. Okay, let's get into the show and forget all the other stuff. This hour, we're going to talk with a Nobel Prize-winning economist about a book that he co-wrote called The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. And the premise of the book is that we haven't been told the full cost of the war in Iraq, and there are a lot of things waiting out there in the future to bite us cost-wise if we don't pay attention to what's going on now. And so we'll talk about the book, and we'll talk with you as well. Let me give the numbers right off the top. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's toll-free, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 227-2050, 227-2050. We also have an email address, talk@wpr.org. So, the title of the book, The $3 Trillion War, joining me by telephone, Joseph Stiglitz, who is one of the authors of the book and a Nobel Prize winner in economics back in 2001. Good morning, Mr. Stiglitz. Thank you for joining our program today.
A pleasure to be here.
The war in Iraq, as you state in your book, has already cost right around $1 trillion by even the most crude accounting methods. Those are just the direct appropriations from Congress. But your premise is that there are a lot more costs out there which are, A, not being considered by anybody, and, B, which are masked by the way the costs of the war are accounted. Is that a fair statement of what
right.
you're talking about?
That's right. And there are also costs that go beyond the budget, beyond the costs that show up on the budget, you know, the costs borne by families, the costs borne by our economy, as we're seeing now.
Well, I'm kind of a linear thinker, especially on days like today. So I'd like to kind of take these things one at a time and go through them.
Sure.
And then hopefully our callers will have other questions that they want to ask. You say that the administration's approach to funding the war has been flawed from the start. What do you mean by that?
Well, the way that they've done the appropriations process is by emergency appropriations, dribs and drabs. We've had 24 bills, separate bills, in a way deliberately designed so that people would not fully understand how much was being spent. But these emergency appropriations are designed for something like Hurricane Katrina, something you can't expect. At the beginning of the war, it may have made sense to have an emergency appropriation, although it was a war of choice and where we had an opportunity to think about it. But 5 years into the war, clearly, there's no justification for relying on these emergency appropriations that don't have the kind of scrutiny that ordinary appropriations have.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, but the funding for the war in Iraq hasn't actually shown up as a part of a budget submitted to Congress. Is that correct?
It doesn't show up in the regular budget. It shows up always as an emergency added on, as if we didn't know we were fighting a war.
Okay, so
there are other problems with the appropriation process. Let me just mention two others. One of them is that the obligations that we are encumbering ourselves with to take care of the disabled veterans who are returning, about 40% of those fighting, 1.65 million have already been deployed. About 40% of these will come back with disabilities. we haven't been putting aside money for these people. We know it's going to be very expensive. We estimate the total cost in excess of $600 billion. No one's talking about that, these expenditures.
You also mentioned something else, and I want you to explain this because I'm not an economist, and I don't even play one on the radio. Thank goodness for that. You point out a difference between cash accounting and accrual accounting, and I wanted to be sure that you explained what you meant by that, because that has a lot to do, I think, with the way we look at how the funding for the war is handled.
Yes, exactly, and the most important example is the one I just gave. Every major business, every business beyond a corner grocery store uses what is called accrual accounting, and that means very simply the following. When you sign a contract, say to buy a car, you may put down a $100 down payment. That's your cash, but you've accrued a liability, an obligation to pay for the rest of the car. By the same token, when you go to war, you pay your troops a certain amount of money up front, but you have what is called deferred compensation, deferred benefits, costs that when you hire him today, you know you're going to be obligated to pay down the line. And among these costs are the retirement benefits and, most importantly, the disability benefits. You don't go fighting a war without having people disabled. In this war, the number of disabled, some very seriously disabled, has been very large.
Now, one of the other issues that's kind of related to this in a way, because there are hidden, it's another example of what you refer to as the hidden costs, hidden war costs in defense spending. The defense budget is somewhere north of $500 billion. I don't have the number right in front of me.
That's beyond the cost of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. But what you say is that there's actually quite a bit of overlap, and that I can kind of understand, because working in a state system, there are times in the year when accounts get swept for any money that hasn't been spent yet, and that gets applied somewhere else. And what you're saying is that this is what's happening in the Pentagon, that money that was appropriated for defense purposes, not related directly to the war, if it doesn't get used right away, it gets swept up and spent on the war. And so that's a cost that's hidden that we aren't counting.
That's right, but it's actually more general than that. I mean, for instance, because the war is so unpopular and because we've treated our troops so badly, it's very hard to recruit troops. And so even, anybody who signs up, it has a liability and a very high chance of going to Iraq. So even for our troops that are stateside, we have to pay them a higher salary, higher benefits, higher enlistment, higher re-enlistment because of Iraq. So we try to take into account some of those kinds of costs as well.
Well, and there are shortfalls in recruiting in the National Guard and Reserves. Applications to West Point and the Naval Academy have fallen from pre-war levels. The military is not seeming such a great career, so we have to spend a lot on bonuses and things of that nature, and so that adds to the cost as well.
That's right. Sorry, I just want to add one more thing to that. That doesn't include some of the, again, deferred costs. Even with those higher salaries, the quality has been going down. The fraction who are high school graduates has been going down. The fraction who are convicted felons are going up. And hopefully after the war, we're going to try to restore the military to its pre-war strength. We are actually less prepared to meet any security needs than we were before the war, and that's going to cost money. That's another example of a deferred cost of this war.
Now, you're also pointing out or suggesting in your book that the cost of the war has effects on other branches of government outside the Department of Defense and Veterans Affairs and so forth, that there are other government departments that that take a hit from this. Explain that, please.
Well, for instance, the most important is Social Security. Social Security disability program pays disabilities no matter how they arise, so that the very large numbers of people coming back that are disabled, as I said, about 40% of the returning veterans are likely to be disabled, some with very serious disabilities. the Social Security program is going to have to be paying out money to take care of them, many of them for their whole lives. So that's a cost that the Social Security system is going to have to pay. The Social Security system is already facing problems. The president has talked about that. They may not be as serious as he said, but there still is a budgetary problem, and these have increased those problems. There are other examples. One of the ones that we were rather scandalized to discover was that the government requires the contractors to have insurance. We've used contractors more than in any other war, and it's actually one of the factors that have helped drive up the cost. We require them to have insurance for disability and death benefits, but the insurance is so expensive that the government winds up paying the premia, mainly through the Labor Department. But then it turns out that these insurance policies have an exclusion clause for deaths and disabilities related, for instance, to hostile actions. And so we're going to wind up paying for the death benefits and disability benefits after paying the premium for many of those who have been injured and killed. So, again, that shows up on the budget of other departments of the U.S. government.
When you were developing this, when you were doing the research to prepare this book, one of the things you did, you went through and you made some calculations and determined, came up with the numbers that you used. You put together a 10-step process. Could you briefly describe the process you used to reach to get the numbers that add up to this $3 trillion that we talk about in the title of the book?
Sure. You know, you begin with the obvious number, the $600 billion that the administration admits to as the direct cost of the war. Interestingly, 10 times what the administration said it was going to cost when we went to war. But then you add in some of the things that we've been talking about. You add in the cost to the budget that show up elsewhere, hidden military costs. That we mentioned in the Defense Department budget. Then you talk about the cost that you're going to have to pay going forward. Even if we decided to leave immediately, it would take a while for us to really pull back our troops. We'd still be there for a while. Almost every scenario sees us there for at least a year or two, almost surely longer than that. Then there's the cost of demobilization. Then there's the cost of restoring the military to its pre-war strength. And then the very large cost we've been talking about, caring for the veterans, disability benefits, and health care. That's the beginning of the budgetary, the main part of the budgetary cost. But this war is unique, the only war in America's history where we have financed this war totally by borrowing, totally on the credit card. In every other war, as we went to war, there was a discussion about shared sacrifice or asking your young men and women to go fight. The rest of America, in a sense, bears part of the cost by raising taxes. This is the first war that, even though we had a deficit as we went into the war, we actually cut the taxes of upper-income Americans. That means every dime has been borrowed. And that means we have to pay interest. We have to pay interest on the interest. And so we calculate what the interest costs are likely to be through, say, 2017. Those are the budgetary costs. But then there are several costs that go beyond the budgetary cost. They're the cost to the families, what we call the microeconomic cost. Somebody who's injured. In one out of five, if there's a serious disability, somebody in the family has to give up a job to take care of them. That's a real economic cost. Doesn't show up in the government's books. So the budgetary cost for disability and death benefits is just a fraction of the total cost to our society. We try to calculate that. And then the final part are the macroeconomic costs. We're paying more for oil. Deficits do matter, and there are macroeconomic consequences of those deficits. We try to explain that, in fact, some of the current economic problems America is facing are, in fact, related to the war. Now, one of the important things I wanted to perhaps emphasize is not all these costs are easy to quantify. And so when we talk about a cost of $3 trillion to actually maybe as much as $5 trillion, we're talking about the quantifiable cost. There are costs that go beyond these costs that are not easily quantifiable.
One of the things, I just looked at the clock and I realized we need to take a break. And then when we come back, we do have people on the phone who want to join us. And we want to encourage that because that's why we're here. So I'll hold my question for later. But we are talking about the book, The $3 Trillion War. We have with us one of the authors of the book, Joseph Stiglitz, who is a Nobel Prize winning economist. And it's an interesting discussion. You can join it. Here are the numbers, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you. Please use 227-2050, 227-2050. You can also reach us via the internet, talk@wpr.org. And we'll be back in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:23. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up this afternoon. Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. After 2 on Science Friday, resuming an old farming practice to revolutionize agriculture and curb global warming. Charcoal as fertilizer. That's after 2 o'clock this afternoon on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the book, The $3 Trillion War. And you can, too, and we're going to go to the phones right now and see if anyone has anything to add to our conversation, and I know they will. First, a little bit of an inside production note to Rhonda. You can go ahead and turn on your IM. Mine is working again. We're trying to piece things together here this morning from the debris left behind by a huge storm that hit northern Wisconsin and northeastern Minnesota overnight with 60-mile-an-hour winds and tons of power outages and all sorts of other disruptions. So, we soldier on, I guess the saying is. Let's go to Jack in Madison first. Jack, you're up. Good morning.
Hi. Yes, I saw your storm on the radar last night. That was a big one.
Well, I got to see it in person, and let me tell you, it looks different than it does on the radar.
Oh, it's quite beautiful. I would like to comment about the amount of money that's available for investment and the fact that people are taking their money and investing it into war profiteering. And we should have been using this period to be designing renewables and all the things that would get us out of that area. And this is an unseen cost that is almost beyond estimation. It has the potential to destroy our economy.
I agree. This is a broad concept that we talk about a lot called the opportunity cost. Some of the critics of the book have said, we could afford it. We're a rich country. We're not spending that much. $3 trillion may seem a lot, but in an economy whose annual GDP is $13 trillion, in 5 years our GDP was $65 trillion. What's the big deal of 3 out of $65 trillion? Not a big deal. Well, the fact of the matter is there are large numbers of unmet needs, and the one that you identified is a really important one, and it cuts a number of different ways. If we had been investing in developing alternative energy sources and ways of conserving more public transportation systems, prices of oil would have come down. That would have helped our domestic economy because we wouldn't be sending so much money over to Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and these other countries, many of whom are using those money in ways that are, to put it mildly, not in our interest. I mean, we complain a lot about Iran. Where is Iran getting all its money from? High oil prices. What is the source of the high oil prices? Well, the fact that we aren't conserving in the way we should. And the Iraq War was the critical factor in driving up the price of oil. So, I was at testifying in Congress on the book, and there was also a security expert, and he pointed, he put it, if you were Iran and you wanted to think about what was the best thing that U.S. could do to help Iran, I said, you know, the war in Iraq could not have helped Iran more.
Thanks for that call, Jack. Let's go next to John in Milwaukee. John, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to put $3 trillion into perspective so that people understand what $3 trillion is. The CIA World Factbook says there's about 25 million citizens in Iraq. If you divide $3 trillion by 25 million, we could have given every single man, woman, and child in Iraq about $120,000. If you were to count a family, a husband, a wife, and two children, we could have given that family $480,000, $500,000 for every family in Iraq. This is unbelievable, incomprehensible to me. And if the United States is actually about 10 times the size population-wise of Iraq. So that $120,000 for every man, woman, and child in Iraq will cost every man, woman, and child in the U.S. about $12,000. So that will cost a husband and a wife with two children about $48,000. This is a lot of money. And people should know this is a lot of money. It's enough money to have given $500,000 to every family in Iraq.
Well, really, let me just thank you so much for putting that, because a lot of people find it very difficult to come to terms with what $3 trillion means, and I think you've put it very, very well. That also explains a little bit why the administration has worked so hard to keep these numbers from the American people. I think if they had known that they were going to be giving, you know, close to $500,000 to every, spending $500 million on every Iraqi, every American family having to family of four to spend close to $50,000, I think the attitudes towards the war would have changed. Our willingness to fight this war, the administration wanted Americans to believe that they could have a war for free, and there's no such thing as a war for free. One of the ways, another way of putting this in perspective, is that what we're talking about here is an order of magnitude greater than the Marshall Plan that helped rebuild Europe at the end of World War II. And yet, we have almost nothing to show for it. The GDP is just recovering to what it was, the pre-war level, and that was after 10 years of sanction. They still don't have clean water, so the problems of cholera. Electricity is not back to the pre-war level. And a country whose major export is oil should be doing fantastically well, given that the price of oil has increased fourfold, and is just barely, you know, getting along, growing at the rate that countries like Iran, that we recognize as have a really major economic problem, growing at 7%. That's not, you know, some people in the administration say, look at that as a mark of success. It's not a mark of success. It's a testimony to the failure that after their deep economic problems with oil prices as high as they are, they could only grow at 7% is really testimony to how bad things are.
One of the things I believe you pointed out in your book is that the Iraqi middle class has pretty much disappeared.
That's right. They've been devastated. One of the reasons that so many people have been dying in Iraq is that, for instance, the number of doctors has been cut in half. Many of them have been killed. The rest have fled. You talk about the number of people who have been killed in violent deaths. But even those who get injuries, whether they're in violent or nonviolent context, there's a lack of medical care. So the death rate in the country is about three times higher than it was before the war. Estimates put that the excess deaths, the increase in the number of people who died greater than what would have been expected in the normal course of events at the rate that existed before 2003 is somewhere in the range of 600,000 to a million. This is an enormous cost the society has faced.
The name of the book is The $3 Trillion War. One of the authors here is with us on the phone is Joseph Stiglitz. who is a Nobel Prize winner in economics, and you can join us as well. We'll be opening up a line for you momentarily. Right now, though, let's go to Rich in Sullivan. Rich, good morning.
We drove back from Rhinelander last night and shouldn't have even been on the road, so you have my sympathy about the storm. We didn't see it on radar. We saw it through a windshield. It's absurd to call this conservatism, and that's what has happened, is that this kind of idiotic accounting has been linked to what some people want to define as conservatism, and it simply is not. As your first caller, Jack, said, we should all conserve, and if you are lucky enough to have any relatives alive who were around during World War II, they will tell you about the immense sacrifices that the entire nation made in order to be at war. We should not be at war or at occupation and call ourselves conservatives if we do not know that, according to Eisenhower, our toil, our resources, our very livelihood are all involved. And he said, so is the very structure of our society. George Bush and his administration has misled people into thinking that this kind of idiotic accounting is somehow patriotic, and worse still, a principle of conservatism. Thank you.
Thanks
for that
call. I agree very
much. And let me just say, another distinctive aspect of this war is that it not only is it the first war that we financed entirely by borrowing, it's the first war time since the Revolutionary War that we've had to go abroad. About 40% of the money has been borrowed from abroad. And so it's another example of an attempt to persuade Americans that they could have, to put it the way economists think, guns and butter. They could have war and not sacrifice anything. But, of course, as economists say, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as a free war. We will be paying for this war. But just the opposite of the conservative principles, we're going to be passing the cost on to our children with interest. So they'll have to pay back far more than if we had paid for it up front. I mean, it's like buying a car on credit. The car may be the upfront cost, but maybe $20,000. But if you borrow it all, by the time you're through, you've paid the car company $40,000.
Well, and all this money is going somewhere. I mean, it's not this. There's real money flowing around out there, and some people are being paid. And you did talk about the costs, some of them being associated with having to take care of wounded and disabled veterans and so forth. But there are people who are making an awful lot of money on this conflict.
Yes, there are only two groups, actually, that have been doing well: the defense contractors and the oil companies, and they've both been doing very well. Halliburton had its stock increased almost threefold. One of the ironies, again, is that the administration sometimes talks about free markets, market principles, but the basic principle that makes markets work is competition. And yet Halliburton's, many of Halliburton's contracts have been these no-bid, no-competition contracts. And so without competition, the prices just soar. But actually, they're even worse than that. A lot of them are what they call cost-plus contracts, which give rise to perverse incentives. The more you spend, they get back everything they spend, plus they make a margin. So their incentive is to spend as much as they can. Now, they respond to those incentives, and they've been spending a lot. Now, there ought to be auditors to watch that, to make sure that that they don't overspend. But the Bush administration has deliberately cut back on the number of auditors, so that their ability to get away with this overcharging has been increased. And that's one of the reasons the number is so large. This war is costing us per troop eight times what previous wars have cost. We're costing us $400,000 per troop. Earlier wars cost us about $50,000, even adjusting for inflation. So it's the way the war has been conducted, in part, that has led to this very, very expensive war.
We're talking about the book, The $3 Trillion War, and I think we're just about at a time when we can take a break. Let me give the phone numbers again for those who'd like to join us and the email. Hopefully we'll be able to keep this thing going till 11 o'clock. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number, just about any place you can hear the broadcast. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you. Please call us at 227-2050, 227-2050. And you can also send an email. Here's the address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. The title of the book is The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. And we're talking with one of the authors of this book, the a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Joseph Stiglitz. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. You are tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:41. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour is Joseph Stiglitz, who is one of the authors of the book, The $3 Trillion War. And before we got interrupted by acts of nature, we had one caller on, I'm sure we lost him by now. Let's just pick up with the next caller, and we'll go next to Virginia in Oshkosh. Virginia, good morning.
Yes, I just heard a glitch, so I hope I stay on.
No, you're all right.
Okay. My question is related to, you mentioned convicted felons are serving in the military. That surprised me because I didn't know they could work for the state or the federal government once they were a felon. And what effect will the non-military people back here who are on SSDI have, what will be the impact on them by military personnel who deservedly deserve disability help and such when they come back? And then while I was waiting, I heard you said we borrowed a lot of money from overseas. How much of that might have come from China? And those would be my questions.
Convicted felon, the military can suspend its normal standards, and many of these are almost surely related to drug-related offenses. I perhaps shouldn't, give too negative of a picture on these. People can be rehabilitated. On the other hand, One of the things that we realized at the very beginning of this war is that we had to win the hearts and minds of the people of Iraq. That was going to require very skilled, it's not just a matter of fighting. It's not just a matter of brute force. It's not just a matter of physical strength. And that was where, having people who are well-educated, know the language, would have been particularly important. And yet, because the way we treat our troops has been so bad, and because the war has been so unpopular, and because of the way the war has been conducted, the president said he would give the troops everything they needed. We discovered, part of a use of the Freedom of Information Act, that military commanders had asked for these MRAPs, these vehicles that are resistant to the IEDs, these explosive devices that have caused so many of the deaths and disabilities. They asked for that as early 2005. Rumsfeld said no, 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 and it wasn't until 2007 when Gates became Secretary of Defense that they were ordered. It's well known that we have not been treating our troops the way we should, and we've had no choice. We've had no choice to go to the contractors, and we've had no choice to lower our standards. But it is a sad commentary on the conduct of the war.
So do these felons just sign up, or does the government recruit them?
Yes, it does. It's looking for bodies. And anybody that can get through, you know, they're paying the recruiters a bonus for the more bodies they can show up with, and they've lowered their standards in order to keep the number of bodies that we need to send over there to have enough bodies to fight this war. The second question, it won't directly affect, obviously, the benefits that others are going to be receiving, but it may affect them indirectly now and in the future. Government worried about the deficits in the long-term financial viability of the Social Security Disability Program. We'll be tempted to raise standards and make it more difficult to put a hassle factor into those who are disabled getting the benefits to which they're entitled. And there are already reports of that going on. In the long run, it contributes to the financial gap. One of the ways that we've tried to explain the nature of how much $3 trillion of the war, $3 trillion that we've been that the war has cost us, has been to point out there's a new metric. You can talk about what fraction of a war we could have solved one problem or another, or how many days fighting would have solved this or that problem. For about 1/6 of the cost of an Iraq war, we could have put the Social Security system on firm financial footing for the next 50, 75 years. That shows you how large this number, $3 trillion, is. You know, the president went to the American people 3 years ago and said, we have a serious problem. We have to partially privatize Social Security. It's bankrupt. It's going to impair the future of our country. Well, the amount that we've been spending and the liabilities that we've incurred, including the unfunded entitlement for these veterans, is as greater than the amounts that he was talking about back then. Finally, as I said, about 40% of the money has been borrowed abroad. It's hard to tell. You can't trace which particular dollar comes from where, but China has been one of the big sources of money. You know, and the contrast between what's going on in the United States and what's going on in China is very marked and says something about the future. Household savings in the United States plummeted in the last couple of years to zero. It's part of the reason that our economy is not in good shape when our icons, financial icons, Merrill Lynch and Citibank had to get additional financing, they had to turn abroad to the sovereign wealth funds elsewhere. And that was because Americans haven't been saving. The contrast is that China has been saving 42% of its income. And actually, while it's been trying to encourage domestic consumption, you know, the people's savings have just kept going up. And so they have a large pool of money. While we've been running deficits, their reserves have increased to $1.5 trillion. And much of that is being held in dollars. Much of that is being lent to help finance the war in Iraq.
Before we go on, I want to make sure that I get this question in because I thought it was really interesting. You did talk earlier about the cost of this war to Iraq's economy and to the Iraqi people, but you also have you spend a little bit of time, and not much, but a little, you talk about the cost of this war to Afghanistan.
That's right. One of the points that we raise is I mentioned before what was something that's called the economic opportunity cost. Money spent on Iraq is money not available to be spent on our country's in very large other problems: health care for children, infrastructure, levees in New Orleans, bridges in Minneapolis. Money, you know, there are limited resources, and if we spend it one place, if we waste it one place, it's not there others. There's also a security opportunity cost. While we were focusing our attention on Iraq, which had no connection with 9/11, no connection with Al-Qaeda. Things have gone very badly in Afghanistan, where there was a connection with 9/11. And Al-Qaeda now has moved into Iraq. So now we have two failed operations, one in Iraq, one in Afghanistan. Actually, the security opportunity cost is broader. You know, the president, when we went to war, he talked about weapons of mass destruction. It was very clear that there were not weapons of mass destruction. Hans Blix from the UN had pointed this out. Lots of evidence. But while we were focusing on weapons of mass destruction that did not exist in Iraq, another country, North Korea, joined the nuclear club. The problems of nuclear proliferation have gotten worse. So, you know, sometimes the president in response to our book has said, what price liberty? What price freedom? The fact is that the result of fighting the war in Iraq is that we are less secure today than we were 5 years ago. Part of that failure is a failure in Afghanistan, where things have been going very, very badly.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Gary in Madison. Gary, good morning.
Good morning. I'd also like to point out that the value of the dollar has just plummeted in recent years, and inflation has gone up. And, of course, the government, the way they report inflation is basically a bunch of BS because they've rejiggered the formula, and inflation is much higher than it's being shown. But one of the problems of our country is the fact we're continually printing digital money, creating money out of thin air since there's no backing for our currency. The rest of the world is prospering because they're not having to fight wars and waste their money. Well, our economy is floundering. And I just wonder the professor's outlook for the U.S. dollar and for inflation. And that's one of the areas that most people don't realize, that rising costs are due to massive increases in the money supply.
Well, this war actually has not been good for the economy. You know, there's a myth that goes back to World War II that wars are good for the economy. It helped the world get out of the global recession. But at least since the time of Keynes, we've understood that you can stimulate the economy in far better ways, in ways that lead to long-term increases in productivity and living standards. Wars don't do that. But this war has been particularly bad for several reasons. First, the money spent on, say, a Nepalese contractor working in Afghanistan doesn't stimulate the American economy in the way that a dollar spent on healthcare, education, research, infrastructure here in the United States. Secondly, and this is relates to your question about inflation, it's not just an accident that the price of oil started to soar just at the time of invasion. Futures markets had predicted that the price of oil would remain around $25 a gallon for the next decade. They understood the increase in the demand from China, other emerging markets, but they anticipated that there would be a concomitant increase in the supply of oil from Middle East, the low-cost providers. And the war changed that equation. It just brought in a new level of instability into the Middle East and set off a dynamic that has led to an increase of $75 to $85. Now, that oil price inflation is now beginning to have broader repercussions because it's leading to increases in food prices. Oil and food agriculture markets have been integrated through biofuels, and so high prices of oil are leading to a shift of production of land into biofuels, meaning less land available for producing food. Food prices are soaring in an unprecedented way. And so, like it or not, we are going to be facing a serious bout of inflation. And the third reason this war is bad, I've already mentioned, is the fact that this war has been totally financed by deficits. Deficits do matter. And that, again, has impaired our future prosperity. Now, the point that you make, I think, is also important, that while we've been squandering our resources in a failed war in Iraq, while our savings has been plummeting to zero, other countries have been investing. They've been using their resources more carefully. And that's why China has been growing at 11%. It just raised its revised their numbers, and growth now reestimated close to 12%. They've been investing in ways that enhance the likelihood of long-term economic growth and increases in living standards in the future, whereas we've been borrowing in ways that mean that we will be saddled, our children, our grandchildren will be saddled with debts, and the money isn't being spent in ways that will increase productivity. It just means that we'll be having to send more and more dollars abroad to those who have been saving. So there is a realignment in global economic powers. We are still the largest economy in the world, but the fact that we had to turn to others to help restore our icons, Merrill Lynch and Citibank, I think says a lot about the new global economic balance of power.
We only have about a minute and a half left in the program here, and I would like to be able to leave on something approaching a positive note. What can we do? Okay, I understand, and my father always told me, when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. What could we do to start to reverse this?
Well, the most important thing is to remember that we're spending $12 billion a month up front. Total costs, if we include the veterans' costs that are, you know, accrued costs that we're incurring, probably doubles that. If we want to stay the course, as some people say, the money is going to have to, it's going to cost us even more. Staying at roughly the same level, expenditures have gone from $4 billion a month up to $12 billion a month. Anybody who says we want to stay the course ought to be saying, and we're going to have to be spending more than $12 billion, more than $25 billion, all-inclusive. That's a lot of money. Stay for another 4 years, we're talking about $1.2 trillion additional money. So I think we have to try to really focus on how we can get out as quickly as we can. That needs to be the center of the debate. How do we get out as quickly as we can? How do we redeploy our resources? Security is important, but we're not buying the most security for our dollars. In fact, it's been counterproductive. Our security has been going down. So we can make a stronger America, a stronger American economy, and more security by rethinking the way we spend money. Resources are scarce. That's the basic law of economics. And if you don't spend your money well, you will bear the consequences. And we are going to be bearing the consequences for decades to come, but we really ought to stop the bleeding now.
And that's where we can leave it. Thank you very much for an enjoyable hour.
Well, thank you.
Joseph Stiglitz is Columbia University. He received the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics in 2001. He's the co-author of the book, The $3 Trillion War. Carmen Jackson produced this program, and thanks to her, Rhonda Fanning and John Treader handled things down in Milwaukee. And again, we apologize for the technical difficulties we had. I guess the more you overtake the plumbing, the easier it is to stop up the drains, as they say. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.